magic wand and e-reader in hand, Harry Potter returned to the spotlight on the publishing industry stage this week. Pottermore, the official digital home of the seven-novel series from J.K. Rowling, launched. In the days ahead, though, when talk turns to evildoing, it's likely to involve old you-know-what. That's right, DRM. There's also word from Random House, sure to raise spirits about the ebook transition. And in reviews, a mystery author makes copyright clear, which is quite a trick if you can manage it. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they get back to work on Monday. And joining me first on the show, as always, from New York, is Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Andrew, good to have you back on Beyond the Book.
Thanks, Chris. Always good to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you back. Tell us what has been happening with regards to the Harry Potter, Pottermore launch, and what does it mean to the rest of the business?
Yes, so this week the big news is that Pottermore, the official digital home of the wildly popular Harry Potter series, launched with all seven Harry Potter titles now available at long last for sale in ebook editions. And you know this is huge news for fans, but it's also proving to be very interesting news for the publishing community, and for a few reasons. The first is that Pottermore is publishing its ebooks in DRM-free editions, or what they say are DRM-free editions. They are apparently watermarked, and there have been some reports that the titles are not without some kind of DRM issues. But by and large, we can say that customers can download the Pottermore ebooks and read them on virtually any device they choose, including the Kindle. Now, frankly, that last part is a huge deal. It appears that Harry Potter is big enough to cast a spell on Amazon, because rather than owning the transaction and locking in Potter fans to the Kindle ebook platform, Amazon is directing customers to Pottermore to complete the ebook purchase. And I believe they're getting something like an affiliate fee for doing so. Now, I'm not aware of any other arrangement in which Amazon allows another party to have that primary customer relationship when it comes to Kindle ebooks. So that's certainly worth noting. Officially, Amazon says it's DRM neutral, that it's going to sell your books with as little DRM or as much DRM as you want. But still, the fact that they're allowing the customer transaction to take place on another platform really is stunning. And it raises the question as to, whether other large franchises will be able to do this at some point. Could James Patterson do it with his books? Will we have, Patterson more coming in the future? It doesn't seem likely, but, the door is at least open a crack now. In addition, Pottermore is also playing nice with libraries. As you recall, we talked, I think, last week about librarians, and they're fretting over the announcement that the ebook lending for the Pottermore, for the Harry Potter books was being delayed. Its agreement with Overdrive was delayed. Well, it came right back on when Pottermore launched. And at a time when libraries have every reason to worry about their future with ebooks, and every reason to doubt that after Penguin pulled its ebooks, that things are actually going to happen, Pottermore stood true to its word, and it's back facilitating ebook lends with Overdrive. So great news there. Library patrons are going to be able to check these books out. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see in the coming weeks and months how Pottermore fares with its DRM-free ebooks and with libraries. And, frankly, I do wonder if the kind of affiliate fee that Amazon is getting might wind up being available to any bookstore that drives a sale to Pottermore. So quite a bit to watch there.
Yeah, interesting questions. And, when it comes to the technology application that must not be named, DRM, you've got a column from Cory Doctorow, who has, he's always been an outspoken opponent of DRM, and he's got some interesting things to say about it this week.
Yeah, that's right. Corey's been a real asset to PW. He's been a contributing editor with us now for over 2 years. He just loves the book business, and he lives in the book business. He's a writer and a publisher, and yet he consistently challenges publishers' thinking, and especially on this topic, the topic of DRM. So in Monday's issue, he's got a great column, once again, about DRM. And of course, most publishers believe that DRM is absolutely necessary on their ebooks to stop piracy. But now you have one of the big franchises out there, Harry Potter, that seems to be siding, at least, partially, for the most part, with Corey on the non-use of DRM. Although it is worth at least pointing out that the Potter books haven't been in ebook editions until now. And I think the series began in the mid-90s. And J.K. Rowling, of course, is a billionaire. So it may be a little easier to experiment with these things, you know, once you got a pile of money in the bank. But nevertheless, Corey makes a lot of sense on these issues, and they're certainly worth exploring. In Monday's column, he points out that while, you know, DRM hasn't really proven to be a great deterrent to piracy, it is proving to be a real problem for ebook customers. And also for the publishing industry, because in practice, once a publisher decides to use DRM, he argues, every cent that your customers spend on DRM-locked ebooks becomes, in his words, a whip for the retailer to beat you with. Because once your customer is locked into a retailer's DRM-locked format, your customer essentially becomes the retailer's customer. You know, the duty cycle of a handheld device like a Kobo or a Nook or a Kindle is about 18 months, he notes. That's interesting, because that means every year or two, customers have the opportunity to switch platforms. But if their ebooks, you know, if their ebooks are, you know, had no DRM, they could just take their libraries with them every couple of years when they move to a new platform, if they move to a new platform. If not, though, this is a real problem because their libraries are locked into a specific platform, and that inhibits their ability to just go to the best platform, and that inhibits competition. So while enabling DRM on ebooks may give some execs peace of mind about piracy, whether or not it actually works to that end, Corey says that DRM is fashioned a scourge for the industry because DRM is what enables retailers to control platforms. You know, it's a hot topic. It's a fascinating one. And now it's, you know, a timely one as well with the launch of Pottermore.
Well, ebooks certainly are timely this year, Andrew, and you know, DRM was a kind of a knee-jerk reaction at the very early stages of all of this when publishers justifiably had jitters about what ebooks were going to mean to their businesses. We're getting some more evidence now that the transition may be going a bit more smoothly than they had feared.
Yeah, so kudos to our friends at Random House because they announced their figures for the year last year. And despite a 4.3% decline in revenue, earnings rose 6.9%. Bertelsmann attributed the improved earnings to some cost-cutting measures, but also lower return rates, higher sales of ebooks, especially in North America, where ebook sales rose by triple digits and accounted for about 15%, I believe, of Random House's worldwide revenue, an increase that pretty much offset the decline in print. In a letter to employees, Marcus Dole said that going forward, that Random House wanted to ensure a healthy and diversified physical marketplace, which means strengthening its brick-and-mortar retail partners and also championing a digital marketplace where multiple retailers can sell our books. You know, and we're seeing what's happening at Random House. We're seeing at other houses as well. Simon & Schuster, Penguin, and Harlequin, for example. Same formula, you know, lower revenue, but higher earnings and margins thanks to digital. So, you know, one quick observation I'll have about this. Obviously, it's great news to see the ebook marketplace proving to be so robust. But I do wonder how much longer authors are going to stand for the standard 25% ebook royalty while publisher profit margins begin to expand. I had a conversation with someone last week that made me think that the fight over ebook royalties could heat up in the coming months. I wish I could say more. I will shortly. But the numbers do seem to bear out what authors have been saying, that digital is proving to be a boon to publishers and, you know, not quite as much to authors. So it definitely seems like something the Authors Guild will want to focus more attention on. Certainly, it seems like it would yield more money for authors than suing libraries over digitizing out-of-print books, which, you know, doesn't seem to really make money for anybody. I understand it's a core principle, but, you know, I do think that as the money begins to roll in on the ebook side for publishers, authors are going to start making some noise over the royalties.
Well, there'll be more noise, speaking of noise, at Book Expo America this year. BEA comes up to New York City again at the Javits Center in June, and the noise is going to be made by the public who are going to be allowed in.
Yeah, so your BEA officials said this week that they're going to actually open the show up this year to the public, moving the plan up by a year. I think we mentioned last week that there was talk of allowing the public in for 2013. Hey, it's going to happen now, although in a somewhat controlled way. Our Judith Rosen reports that BEA will get its feet wet with the public offering by giving away, offering 1,000 tickets to publishers and some bookstores that they can distribute to readers who want to attend the final day of the show, which I think is Thursday, June 7th. In addition, BEA is reaching out to consumers with live streaming events and a lot of author events on the web. So that's good stuff. I think that's an idea whose time has come, and I can't wait to see what it's like having the public at the meeting. I'm sure it'll kick up the action on the last day of the show. I'll also note that Monday's issue of PW is our Russia supplement, and as fate would have it, Russia is the featured country at BEA this year. There's a one-day global market forum called Read Russia on Monday, June 4th, and that overlaps with a Read Russia festival, which runs from June 1 to 8, and that's going to be held at venues throughout New York City, and it's going to feature heads of the major Russian publishers, as well as distributors, all of whom will be at the BEA forum, and about 25 Russian writers as well that are going to showcase Russian literature and include an exhibit of children's book illustrations. So, get ready for some Russia at this year's BEA.
Well, as we say in Moscow, Andrew, Harasho and spasiba. So thank you, Andrew Albanese.
I'm going to have to take your word on that.
All right. That means very nice, and thank you indeed. Now we're going to turn to Rose Fox, our PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, we look forward to hearing what you've got for us this week in the Review of Reviews.
Our fiction section starts with an unusual protagonist. The book is Albert of Adelaide. It's a debut novel by the 66-year-old Australian Howard Anderson, and it features a most memorable character. Albert is a duck-billed platypus, and he flees the captive monotony of Adelaide Zoo in search of the old Australia, if such a thing still exists. And the novel is populated by a lively assortment of vagabond wombats, bandicoots, and a Tasmanian devil.
Well, you know, Rose, I have to say, there's so much about that book that sounds so enticing. Not only just the idea of a duck-billed platypus as a character, but that this is a debut by a 66-year-old.
And I love that it's a novel. It sounds like something you would expect to see as the premise for a children's book or maybe a picture book. Instead, here it is being pitched to adults. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how this one does. We also review Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mandel, which is the sequel to Wolf Hall, which won the Man Booker Prize. And this installment follows Thomas Cromwell's continuing efforts to extricate King Henry VIII from his unhappy marriages. We cover Gilded Age, which is something of a modern retelling of Edith Wharton's House of Mirth. That's by Claire McMillan. And it's a hard-edged look at the vacuous, insipid elite of Cleveland, Ohio, told in both first and third person, which allows us to get to know the increasingly unlikable narrator. We have side-by-side reviews of two books by Alex Olin. Signs and Wonders is a short story collection in which characters grapple with the trapping of love and loss, bumbling through life, accepting the hand that they've been dealt. And also Inside, which is a novel in the form of three interlock stories about three broken people on the hunt for fulfillment. And we have a Q&A with prominent Russian author, there's Russia again, Michael Shishkin. He talks about being translated and how in Russia it's very important to never be a slave to the market.
Well, you know, there's a book you review in Mysteries and Thrillers that everybody at Cartwright Clarence Center, I would think, would find a fascinating read, Harlem Requiem.
Yeah, this is kind of a nerdy mystery novel. Paul Goldstein is the author, and it's about an intellectual property specialist who helps an elderly Cuban musician seek rights to the music that he and his friends wrote in the 1940s and 50s. And the intellectual property lawyer takes a trip to Cuba, and then there's a murder, and then things get interesting. But our reviewer says that the law professor author excels at making the dry subject matter interesting all the way through, both accessible and fascinating, even to people who really don't know anything about copyright. So I think it's got quite a broad audience there, in addition, of course, to all you lovely folks at CCC. We also cover The Seventh Gate by Richard Zimler. This is a coming-of-age epic set in 1932 Berlin and featuring a 14-year-old girl who must solve an anti-Semitic murder as the Nazis consolidate their power. And we have a Q&A with Gillian Flynn, who talks about moving away from writing about damaged people to create an alpha female lead character for her novel Gone Girl. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, Vicki Pedersen's The Taken launches a new supernatural mystery series set in present-day Las Vegas, and it features a rockabilly reporter who loves everything about the 1950s and a tough guy angel who lived and died in the actual 1950s. We also cover John Scalzi's Red Shirts, takes on Star Trek's known trope for having the nameless, faceless officers go down to the planet and die there. And in this book, an ensign decides to find out why exactly the junior officers keep dying in spectacularly dramatic ways while the upper echelons remain unscathed. In romance, My Fair Concubine by Jeannie Lin is a version of My Fair Lady set in 9th century China. A soldier's sister runs away from an arranged marriage, and he decides to turn an orphaned servant into an elegant noblewoman to take her place. Also, editor Christina Wright presents Lustfully Ever After, 17 European fairy tales turned into erotic romance stories, including one that incorporates fairy magic into a story of gender transition and true love.
Well, in the Q&As in nonfiction this week, you've got somebody contemplating the value of free advice, as well as somebody explaining a rather difficult subject matter.
Yeah, we have a Q&A with Florence William, who's the author of Breasts, which we talked about, I think, last week or the week before. And she says it is a little awkward telling elderly relatives that she wrote a book about mammary glands, but when she explains that it's about health and the environment, they get interested. And we have another Q&A with Augustine Burroughs, author of the smart, sassy, and forthright advice book, This Is How. And he says he's always found other people's problems to be quite fixable, and he cheerfully admits he often fails to follow his own advice. In reviews, David Nyoz's Nonbeliever Nation explores the growing demographic of America's atheists and agnostics, and he suggests that increasing secularity offers hope for more rational, inquiry-based public policy. William J. Dobson's The Dictator's Learning Curve examines authoritarian regimes in countries around the world, focusing on the ways that modern-day dictators promote economic prosperity while relying on political apathy to stay in power. And Amanda Bennett's The Cost of Hope is an affecting memoir of her 20 years of marriage. After her husband was diagnosed with kidney cancer, the two of them decided to focus on doing what they love and watching their children grow up, both fighting the disease and living each day to the fullest. In the lifestyle section, Martha Stewart has a new book, Martha's American Food. She sells an appealing version of Americana, updating rustic and homey fare with fresh regional ingredients. A reviewer says it's a fine addition to the Martha Stewart canon. And we also have What's Wrong with My Kid by George E. Leary Jr., which is a practical yet compassionate guide for parents who worry that their children may be addicted to drugs or alcohol. And it also tells them what to do if they are. In children's books, we have 6 picture books that investigate the large and diverse world of insects. We have another picture book, Hide and Seek by Il Sung Na, turns a game of hide and seek in a rainforest into a joyful spectacle, and young readers will enjoy spotting the chameleon, who of course wins every game. Christopher Healy's The Hero's Guide to Saving Your Kingdom, in which 4 disgruntled princes are forced to team up and battle evildoers plotting against their kingdoms, updates fairy tale tropes with what our reviewer says is a fresh contemporary sensibility and laugh-out-loud lines on nearly every page. And Kristen Kishore follows Graceling and Fire with the long-awaited young adult novel Bitter Blue. This is a sprawling tale of palace intrigue in which the young queen of Monsey learns how to rule and finds romance. And in the Annex this week, we have Mark Sundin's The Man Who Quit Money. This is the fascinating tale of Daniel Suelo, the man who left his last $30 in a truck stop phone booth in 2000, and has not earned, received, or spent a single dollar since. He lives in a cave and lives off the land, though he's not entirely off the grid. He maintains a blog about his experiences. And that's it. There's no pick of the week this week, so those are the reviews.
Wow, that sounds like a heck of a story. A man off the grid, but not entirely, and always able to find a way to get his blog updated. Thank you so much for that, Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs herself at John Reville.
You're very welcome.
And Andrew Albanese will say thanks to you this time in English. Andrew Albanese is PW's features editor. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Ah, merci beaucoup.
And De Rien, comme on dit en Paris. All right. So Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.